from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, cabinet picks, gun talks, and the flu all over. Joe Biden talked guns at the White House. Up in New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo gave voice to urgency as he proposed what he called the toughest assault weapon ban in the nation.
It's simple. No one hunts with an assault rifle. No one needs 10 bullets to kill a deer.
A dangerous flu season. 42 states reporting surging numbers. Dozens have died. Dr. David Rosenberg was dealing with an outbreak in Florida.
It's been an epidemic, and it's been huge, and there's been a lot of admissions from the flu, more than ever.
And on Thursday, President Obama nominated Jack Lew, his current chief of staff, to be Treasury Secretary. The president had some fun with Lew's now famous looping scrawl of a signature that would end up on U.S. dollar bills.
Jack assures me that he is going to work to make at least one letter legible in order not to debase our currency, should he be confirmed as Secretary of the Treasury.
Just one letter. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with NPR's Tom Gelton, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. With us this hour from Washington is Tom Gelton, national security correspondent for NPR. Tom, welcome back to On Point.
Well, hi, Tom. Good to be back with you.
Great to have you. And from New York City, Diane Brady joins us, senior editor and content chief for Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, wonderful to have you back as well.
Nice to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Diane, and Tom.
The president and President Hamid Karzai meet today on, well, the way ahead, 2014. By the end thereof, we're supposed to be out. What that means, I guess, is on the table. I want to look at cabinet picks and banks and a lot today. But, Tom, let's just dive in right there. Two presidents talking today. What's on the table between Obama and Karzai?
Well, Tom, first of all, I'd have to say that I have great sympathy not only for President Obama but for his predecessor, President Bush, in dealing with Hamid Karzai. This has got to be one of the most difficult personalities on the planet to negotiate with. I mean, it's very easy to sort of see him as kind of an ungrateful president, considering the expenditure of blood and treasure by the United States and by men and women there over the last 10 years. He still is very critical of the United States. He is right now sort of balking at what's called a status of forces agreement, which is basically sets down the rules by which U.S. forces would continue their presence in Afghanistan. This is precisely the kind of issue that actually ended the U.S. presence in Iraq when the Iraqi government imposed really difficult conditions.
Who wants what here, Tom?
Well, I think that what Karzai has been saying is that he is reluctant to give U.S. forces immunity for any actions that they take in Afghanistan. Of course, the big issue is how many troops will stay in Afghanistan.
If there's nobody there, they don't need immunity. They're talking zero option as one option.
They're talking zero option. The Afghans would be very much left in the lurch if that were the case. You could very likely see the country descend into a civil war. It looks to me like that's a bit of a negotiating tactic, basically saying to Karzai, look, if you put really difficult conditions on our staying, we'll just pull everybody out. See how you like that.
Jack Beatty, here we are. It's just a few days, under 2 years now, until American and other troops, so what, have their pullout. But what that means, the question here, what do you see in these talks, Jack, with about 2 years to go?
Well, that zero option is the first I'd heard of that. Whether it's a negotiating ploy or not, it's encouraging because prior to that, we'd heard, 10,000, 15,000, which according to the New York Times is the range that Karzai would like to have indefinitely. You know, he comes
to us. That is
U.S.
troops in Afghanistan after the so-called end of engagement or whatever there.
That's right. Training, use it as a commando force to strike at Al-Qaeda, that sort of thing. But, you know, he comes to us as the head of a government that Transparency International has called the world's most corrupt. He comes to us as the recipient of a decade and more of U.S. aid and blood and treasure. And this week, the Times did a piece about farmers in Helmand Province. They had to get rid of their poppies, their opium, And they looked to the government. The government promised, do that, and we'll give you something else to plant. Cotton, I think, was talked about. Nothing from the central government. What are the people in Helmand saying now? Maybe we should deal with the Taliban. I mean, this is what this man and this engagement has brought us. 12 years, 11 years, and we're right here facing, you know, failure either now or later.
I mean, what does it mean? So we could just go away and it's Afghanistan's problem, or is it, Tom Gelton? I mean, is it clear how this is going to work and who's going to end up with the leverage here?
Well, the big question is whether Afghanistan, the Afghan authorities and the Afghan troops have the capability to sort of maintain order in that country on their own without U.S. troops. I think that Afghanistan is in a lot better shape to do that now than it was a decade ago. But there is the possibility that the country would just descend into sort of warlord-ruled regions, civil war. And, of course, the big fear is that under those conditions of chaos and anarchy, that al-Qaeda could reestablish sanctuaries in Afghanistan, which is precisely the situation that led to U.S. involvement there in the first place 11 years ago. So those are the issues.
And with that, Jack Lew, we'll come to you, Diane Brady, on our Treasury Secretary, our economy, banks, and all the rest. But
going
also
to the safe subject.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know where safety is these days. At least those killer whales are free. We've got Chuck Hagel up for Secretary of Defense. We've got John Brennan up to head the CIA. Here was the president on Monday with those nominations coming out.
As these leaders know, the work of protecting our nation is never done, and we've still got much to do. Ending the war in Afghanistan and caring for those who have borne the battle. Preparing for the full range of threats, from the unconventional to the conventional, including things like cybersecurity. And within our military, continuing to ensure that our men and women in uniform can serve the country they love, no matter who they love.
Okay, President Obama there. Tom Gelton, I think it's back to you here. First on Chuck Hagel, even before his name was formally put forward, a huge hubbub in the background over his past positions, over his position on Israel, on Iran, even charges of anti-Semitism. People have come back and said, stop that. But there's that name, and where do you see it going on that front, Tom?
We had a commentator this week on Morning Edition, Tom, who said that Chuck Hagel has offended everyone omnidirectionally, and I'm afraid that's the case. Although technically a Republican, of course, he supported Barack Obama in 2008, so a lot of Republicans don't consider him a Republican anymore. Although technically a Republican, he doesn't seem to have any Republicans lining up to support him. He has, of course, run into trouble with gay rights groups for his comments regarding gays in the past. He's clearly an independent thinker, and there is consistency in his view right now of where the United States should be going from a national security point of view. He's very much in favor of pulling back from costly engagements overseas. He would work for reductions in defense spending, and you know, he would probably be one of those that might consider that zero option for Afghanistan. So there is a position that he represents. Now, whether he can convince a majority of the U.S. Senate to support his confirmation, I guess, is the big question.
I mean, the tradition is the Senate, yes, they've got consent, but they typically tip the hat and nod to the president and off they go. Is it a real question here, Tom?
Especially when it's a former senator. I mean, there is this kind of deference to former senators. I think the betting is that probably when push comes to shove, he would get confirmed. But, with both him and Jack Lew's confirmation, there's no doubt that Republicans will use those confirmation hearings as opportunities to really criticize, interrogate, attack Obama administration foreign and fiscal policies.
Diane Brady, let me turn to you on Jack Lew. He's been right in the heart of the Clinton administration. The Obama administration turned in three, budget surpluses, President Obama was eager to point out as he introduced him. What about in the business world, which we'll be chiming in, I guess, on Treasury Secretary, but let's look away from Washington. What's the reception of this nomination up in your turf, New York, Diane?
I think it's quite positive, and it does signal very much that the president is going to be focused on those big questions of the debt and the budget. He is not a colorful personality who hangs out in his ski boots at Davos, so he's probably not as well known on the international front as Tim Geithner, but there's no question he's well known in Washington, and he's tackled some of those really, really tough discussions and debates over the debt ceiling and everything else. So I think generally the reaction is positive, and there's a nod to the fact that that is going to be the focus of the second term.
Jack Beatty, the resistance in Washington to Jack Lew seems to have come from Republicans saying, whoa, wait a minute, he's too tough in the president's corner here. He's a trench fighter.
Yes, he's Bob Woodward in his book on the 2011 showdown over the debt ceiling has John Boehner saying, I don't want him in the room. He offends people. But other people say, well, the reason is because he's an expert. He knows the numbers. He knows what they mean. You really can't trick him on any of that. You know, but other people are looking at another part of his profile. While at Citicorp, briefly, in 2008, he took nearly $1 million in bonuses. And, of course, those bonuses were very controversial because later in 2008, Citicorp got billions of money from the government. And his views on what caused the financial crisis have also come under scrutiny. He, in 2010 Senate testimony, he said, I don't believe that deregulation was the proximate cause. Well, a lot of people would strongly disagree with that.
Of course, there he was in the Clinton administration where a lot of that went on. Jack Beatty, Tom Gelton, Diane Brady, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at a week in the news. Big cabinet picks this week. Guns, flu, all in the headlines. On Tuesday, the vice president said he will deliver recommendations for an Obama push. Here he is on Thursday after meeting with various gun rights and gun control groups, saying there's an emerging consensus on some possible new gun laws.
There's an emerging set of recommendations not coming from me, but coming from the groups we've met with. And I'm going to focus on the ones that relate primarily to gun ownership and the type of weapons can be owned. And one is there is a surprising, so far, a surprising recurrence of suggestions that we have universal background checks. Not just close the gun show loophole, but total universal background checks.
So he brought in different sets of people on this, including Walmart, where lots of guns are sold, the NRA. NRA sat down, but then said they would not do that again. And here was its president, David Keene, CNN, Thursday, saying there would not be an agreement on an assault weapons ban, so says the NRA chief.
Now, if the question is, should we ban guns? Should we ban so-called assault weapons? Should we do that? Should we do the other? There's not going to be an agreement there. If the question, however, is how, as the vice president put it, how do we deal with the problem of these kinds of shootings, I think then there is an area for agreement.
I want to go to our whole panel on this, but we've got lots of listeners paying close attention to the gun conversation. Let's go to Springfield, Illinois, and John Michael. John Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Real quickly, I'd like to kind of summarize my situation and the community that I'm in. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, an upper mid-class community where the vast majority of people own guns, so it's a hot topic for everybody. And where these people are basically starting from is, you know, they've been shooting and guns, you know, for recreational or sport purposes,
okay,
from childhood through adulthood, and it's never been a problem for them or anyone they know. So they basically have attitudes like, look, they're safe. It's not our problem. It's a crime problem. It's this or that.
A lot of parents in Newtown, Connecticut see it as a big problem. So what happens now, John? What happens now?
Well, what seems to be happening is there is a lot of agreement on that, you know what, we really ought to have universal background checks, including all private sales, and probably gun licensing. Well, a license for gun ownership that does involve safety training. The red lines that do seem to get pretty much everyone really fired up are any talks about banning basically anything that's not currently practically banned. and individual registration of firearms.
John, let us pick it up right there. Of course, there's not much banned right now. Jack, what do you see coming here? The vice president seems to be saying he's looking at the art of the possible here. On the other hand, with the Newtown killings and more school gun problems this week, there are a lot of people out there saying we need a watershed here. But what does that look like to Joe Biden?
Well, he's up against the clock. I'm looking at a graph of the issue attention cycle. That's basically the amount of attention television gives to these issues. And it shows three peaks for Virginia Tech, Aurora, and the Gifford shooting. They go way up, and at the end of 5 weeks, attention mentioned on TV is right back to where it was before the shooting.
Okay.
5 weeks. Well, we're about three and a half and counting on that
Newtown.
On that timetable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is a difference now. Speed. You know, Joe Califano wrote a piece in the Washington Post after Newtown saying, look, here's what LBJ did when he got through the last big gun control bill after Robert Kennedy's assassination. He got his people together. He says, you've got to act fast. This has to happen now before the gun people can gun lobby can regroup and look at the speed with which Governor Cuomo is moving. Next week, legislation could be passed. The speed with which Mr. Biden and the administration is moving, that's encouraging. Second, money. I mean, suddenly the people on the gun control side have some money. Witness what happened on Sunday. Heidi Heitkamp, the newly elected senator from North Dakota, criticized the administration as going too extreme on some of these proposals. Within 48 hours, ads were running in North Dakota and in Washington showing a graveyard of little crosses and saying, Heidi Heitkamp, whose side are you on? The murderers are the sane people. And the next day she put out a mollified statement. Finally, there's this split in the GOP that opened up on two votes last week on the debt, on the fiscal cliff and on Sandy, where you had striking differences between Republican representatives from the Northeast and far West vis-a-vis the Deep South. And, you know, if you look at that, there are 12 members in that caucus from New York and New Jersey, 13 from Pennsylvania, 44 from the upper Midwest, 20 from the far West. Point is, there are possible votes there for something that would push the ball forward. Whether it would really make the country safer, one doesn't know. But it's certainly more hopeful than it seemed just a few weeks ago.
Diane Brady at Business Week, Bloomberg Business Week, there in New York City. I know you're not counting noses in Congress, but we come to this issue on guns,
yeah.
and we open the phones, and the first call from right in the middle of the country, Springfield, Illinois, says the vast majority of the people that our caller John knows have guns. And it's interesting. He says, yes, they're open to universal background checks, safety training for everybody, but no new restrictions on the availability of the guns themselves. How does that strike you, Diane, where we're headed here?
Well, it seems like we haven't really clarified the debate enough to show that there isn't really any, you know, single, Second Amendment restrictions here. But I will point out, I do actually count noses, and I note that more than half the members of Congress, I think, have an A rating from the NRA. And we know the NRA, in fact, sees this as an opportunity to put more, armed people into schools to protect them. So I think that the issue ultimately, when it comes to assault weapons, I think there is more of a consensus than we think. One of the disturbing things, I think, that has altered the debate somewhat are these moves to actually go and publicize gun ownership. And some, I think the media really takes some responsibility here where we've seen these cases of
what disturbs you. This is where the newspaper that said,
Orwellian.
Here's where the people live who own guns in our neighborhood.
Yes, because you don't want to be vilifying Americans who own guns, especially when you have more than 300 million weapons in this country. There's no magnet that's going to go through and suck all that up. The issue here is the restrictions, the background checks. Everybody was horrified by Newtown. Everybody understands you really don't need to have those type of weapons on the streets. So if they could crystallize the debate and try to bring it down a little more to those issues and a little less to the evils of gun ownership, I think that would probably help us through.
Well, I'm not so sure that everybody agrees you don't need those type of weapons on the street. In fact, you can see from public statements, it's quite clear not everybody does agree with that.
Yeah.
It was interesting in terms of this cultural moment this week, of course, was the second anniversary of the shooting in Tucson that almost took the life of a Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and her astronaut husband Mark Kelly, they were talking out this week, said, look, we're gun owners, but something has to change here. Here they were with Diane Sawyer of ABC News. They've started a new political action committee to promote gun regulation. They talked about visiting Newtown. The two of them actually went this week meeting with parents of the victims there. You'll hear Mark Kelly first, then Sawyer asking a question, and then a word from Gabby Giffords.
Dad took out his cell phone and showed us a picture of his daughter, and I just about lost it. You know, how do we get to the point where 85% of the children in the world that are killed with guns are killed in the United States? That is a sobering statistic.
So that's what changed for you?
Yes.
That plus, very sadly, that the bullet that she herself took 2 years ago in Tucson. Tom Gelton, you're watching in Washington. Do you see an inflection point on policy here? How ambitious do you think the vice president will be? What do you think is the art of the possible, if that's what we're talking about here?
An interesting and important point, Tom. You know, Joe Biden worked for the assault weapons ban that was put in place back in the 90s. That is now widely seen. Of course, it's since been expired.
Yeah.
But that is now widely seen as having been ineffective. And one of the reasons it was ineffective is in order to get enough votes to pass it, he had to put in so many limits and compromises that really reduced its effectiveness. And, of course, there are fewer Democrats in Congress now than there were back in the 90s. On the other hand, the idea of universal background checks really does seem to have some prospect of moving forward right now. And interestingly enough, the Brady campaign, which is one of the leading, if not the leading, gun control groups in America, has come out with a statement saying that in their judgment, background checks would actually be more important, would be a better contribution to reducing gun violence than another assault weapons ban. That's, you know, closing what we referred to earlier, closing the gun show loophole. Our caller John said
that is that no background checks on gun show purchases.
Exactly. And as John, the caller, said, he detects support for that, even though he does not see support for banning weapons. So I would predict that in terms of the art of the possible, that's the issue that we should really probably be zeroing in on.
Let's get a call from Campbellsville, Kentucky. Kelly. Kelly, what do you think? Hello, Kelly. Are you there, my friend?
I am.
What do you think on guns,
I've been
Kelly?
Listening to this gun issue for several weeks now, and I worked 30 years in the mental health system and got out because I couldn't ethically work in the system any longer. And since the late 70s, when we had deinstitutionalization, we pretty much decimated our mental health system in the U.S. And individual mental health rights trumps community rights. And I practice in Michigan, and Michigan passed a law that was now able to involuntarily require individuals with mental health problems to take their medications, and if they didn't, they could put them in a mental health hospital.
You think our gun problems are all about mental health?
That's not across the nation. So if you look at these individuals who have been involved in these mass shootings, all of them seem to have mental health issues, but we don't have a mental health system that's adequate to even meet their needs, and quite frankly, many of them probably wouldn't even be in the mental health system.
Kelly, let us pick it up if we may, and thanks for your call, Jack. I mean, clearly, we've seen in these the court hearings in Colorado this week. You look at the killer there, and you think, oh, this young man needed help. I mean, presumably, you had something similar in Newtown. On the other hand, go all the way back to Columbine. Who knows if those young guys really would have fallen to a screen like that? How much of this response to the agony of Newtown do you expect to go in the mental health direction, Jack, versus the actual guns registration, background checks, the rest?
I think it's going to have to be a combination to appeal to that possible vote, because, you know, gun rights advocates rightly point to these laws, to the deinstitutionalization of the seriously impaired. And I see that in the New York law, there's going to be an effort to the bill that's being debated now and may pass next week, that they're going to try to strengthen their civil commitment proceedings, so that judges will have more of a, you know, latitude in committing people who potentially, you know, are a danger to themselves or others. The civil liberties question is that potentially, how do you tell? Well, I mean, I've been listening to enough psychiatrists talk on the air. They seem to feel that, you know, you can tell if you can roughly tell. If you get some sort of screening.
But our caller says, look, I worked in the mental health system. We're not equipped to handle the problem, you know, because we've changed our institutions.
Right, and that's where the administration could perhaps do something through executive action, or at least that was conjectured this week, that the president could bolster mental health programs sort of by sidestepping Congress, maybe by providing more money to the states. Of course, where that money comes from would have to come from someplace else.
Tom Gelton, we heard the New York State Governor, Andrew Cuomo, at the top of the hour saying you don't need 10 rounds to kill a deer. Of course, they're talking about an assault rifle ban there, a ban on big clips. I guess maybe this goes state by state after all, Tom.
I think that the White House, Tom, would actually welcome that development. I mean, President Obama has become such a target of, you know, I think hatred is not too strong a word, and certainly very intense criticism, that to the extent that governors can carry this ball, I think the White House would welcome it. It's not just New York. The governor of Colorado is also strongly pushing some new limits. And also, you know, you quoted Gabby Giffords. I mean, to the extent that others can be making this argument and actually working on legislation and new proposals, I think that takes a little bit of the pressure off the Obama administration. You know, I don't know if you saw it, Tom, or not, but the Drudge Report, which is always, I think, an interesting index of conservative thinking, when the first mention of executive action by the White House in this area came out, the Drudge Report highlighted that with pictures of Stalin and Hitler on the front page. That gives you an indication of the feeling about the Obama administration being the lead actor here.
But let us not forget the intensity of criticism and concern that grew out of those killings themselves, all those dead children in Newtown, and everybody knows, Diane, that guns flow across state lines like water. If you kick it back to the states, does that really step up to the Newtown moment?
I think the states are very powerful in this whole debate. And let's not forget that Adam Lanza, the man who did the shootings, he was using his mother's guns. So you don't want to complicate too much the mental health issues. There are many reasons why people would not want to be granting gun licenses to certain people, including criminal background checks. And there are many mentally ill people who are not a danger when it comes to this sort of mass murder. So I think that is something that complicates the debate again. But I think the states, New York State, clearly New York City, this has actually made a difference. And I think that, in fact, the states are powerful actors here and can't be ignored.
The clock ticking, Jack, you say, and the national attention here, though it is bigger than I remember it, it seems to have more staying power so far. How quickly do you think we may see something? Joe Biden's going to say, here we go. Can they get something done, I don't know, even before Inauguration Day?
Well, wouldn't that be something? And if not, you can be sure that the president will use that inaugural speech as a bully pulpit to make the case for this bill. But that's the LBJ model. He told his people, you've got 10 days, basically. You've just got to do this overnight. And wouldn't it be something if they actually had legislation to Congress within the next week or so?
We've just got a couple of days, and we'll know what Joe Biden, the vice president, is going to be pushing here. Jack Beatty, please stand by. Tom Gelton of NPR, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, nobody was voted into the Baseball Hall of Fame from the era of widespread steroid use that tainted the game. Here's ESPN's Tony Reale.
No Bonds, no Clemens, no Sosa, no Piazza, no McGuire, no Palmeiro, nobody elected into the Hall of Fame this year.
There were bountiful Oscar nominations for Life of Pi, Les Mis, Silver Linings Playbook, and most of all for Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
We must cure ourselves of slavery. This amendment is that cure.
And 11 great killer whales trapped in ice in northern Canada have apparently made their way to freedom. It was tense as the world watched them sharing a small hole in the ice to breathe. Things to be glad for. Glad they're out of there, though there was speculation that it may have been changing climate patterns that left them confused and trapped. We're looking at a week in the news. Diane, Tom, Jack, lots of response on the gun front here online. And TF says, Diane, saying you don't want to vilify people who own guns with it, putting out the maps and who owns what where. He says, why not? On the other hand, Dr. Sanchez says, why demonize a group of people because of the actions of 0.01% of the population? Fair enough. On the other hand, talk to the parents and families in Newtown. Dave says, why not tax ammunition heavily? That would be a major deterrent just from a financial perspective. Somebody else here, Alexandra says, beyond bans and on assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, what about requiring gun owners to carry liability insurance for each and every firearm they own? We'll see. And this I'll put to you, Diane. It's interesting. This theme came up right after Newtown. But G writes to us, look, it's about the big gun companies profiting from this. We talk about the big oil companies. Why not use the same term for the gun industry? What about that industry, Diane? We saw big private equity getting out of gun company ownership right after the killings. You know, maybe follow the money here. Is there a trail there that tells us what's anticipated?
Well, I certainly think, the NRA is potent, the gun lobby is potent. But, I think one of the companies that is in the spotlight now is Glock, though they are the producers of guns that brought us these, assault rifles and such. And I think the issue there is that it's changed the game. And so I think the gun companies, I think what Cerberus did in getting out of the business is indicative that they see more restrictions coming down the pipe. But they're not so much the focus, I think, as the NRA, which is clearly both the gun manufacturers, but also the gun owners, hunters, et cetera. There are many people, I think, that are supportive, including, as we know, politicians in Washington.
Let's go just a little more on guns. Melly in Nashua, New Hampshire. Melly, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I always love your show.
Thank you.
I wonder whether you and your guests could elaborate on what these background checks are, because as far as I know, I don't think in any of these recent mass shootings, I don't think there was a history that the shooters were going to be violent. What kind of checks are they putting in? Are they thinking of putting in place that would actually identify potentially future shooters?
Yeah, I mean, we've got more to look at here, but let us take it, Amelie, and thanks for your call. Jack, I mean, here was Adam Lanza. They were his mom's guns. Not his. So whatever was up with him, it would not have surfaced, I guess, this trouble brewing. Does that mean Joe Biden is kind of trimming in advance of really getting at the problem?
Well, I mean, people who simply aren't in the system. On the other hand, experts say that the system is so porous as it exists that the database the FBI uses to perform these background checks on gun buyers doesn't include a lot of information. For example, information from the Social Security Administration about the mental competence of prospective buyers or about failed drug tests or things of that sort. And one reason is the states, which are supposed to furnish this information, have been laggard. Only a few states do it. And they say, we don't have the money to do it. Well, here's a point. Here's some place where perhaps executive action, perhaps legislation could incentivize the states to, furnish more of that information.
We'll see where things go. Talk about bewildering stories. Diane, I want to come to you on the AIG story. There was the word this week that AIG was considering suing the U.S. government, I guess, over the terms of the country's bailout of AIG when it was in very dire straits. Now, that's gone away. But what was that about in the first place? Why was that even on their minds, Diane?
Well, and AIG did a remarkably poor job, I think, of communicating this to the public. Hank Greenberg, who was the man who led AIG for four decades, mm-hmm. has sued his former employer. He wanted AIG to join him in this suit to basically say that bailout that we all remember oh so well came at the expense of shareholders and it was not necessary in retrospect. He's maintained that all along. AIG has a duty. The board had a fiduciary duty to listen to Hank Greenberg. He's a major shareholder. They would have put themselves in a corner if they'd not considered the request. I suspect they did not seriously consider the request. It was a unanimous vote by the board. They've put out ads saying, thank you, America. This is not a company that's looking to go back and revisit the history of the bailout. But they had to do it for Hank. They gave it a fair airing, they'd like to say, and now it's back to business as usual.
Thanks, America, for the bailout, and here's a lawsuit. That would have been tough. Let me ask you, on another banking front, this $8.5 billion in fines on 10 banks that were involved in, I guess, mishandling the process of foreclosure. That sounds like a lot of money, but there's been fierce criticism, Diane, saying, look, banks off the hook again. It really amounts to no big deal for them and very little for families who were tossed out of their homes.
It's true, but I think what's interesting is you have seen the banks actually in the last 12 months really being brought to task for this, for how they've manipulated LIBOR. I mean, there's all sorts of issues, I think, where people are starting to actually hold the banks accountable. Even Citigroup, we mentioned before, Vikram Pandit's pay. So I think on the one hand, you could say it's doesn't compensate the families, but it really is a black eye against the banks. I think there's some reputational damage, and we're talking billions, so it is not chump change. It may not hurt their bottom line, but it is at least something to acknowledge that behavior matters.
But I think I read something like families who got hit by this might get $1,500. I mean, what is that? A month's rent? Here's a housing advocate, Bruce Marks, CEO of Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, saying on Fox News that Monday's settlement with major banks over foreclosure practices was not enough. He argued that the banks foreclosed on thousands of properties unnecessarily.
If you talk to the independent consultants, what they say is that they're documenting that the banks had modifications that were available for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of homeowners, and those banks didn't give those homeowners the opportunity to save their homes. So they lost their homes.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? You got the banks running scared, watching their minding their P's and Q's now on the backside of that $8.5 billion?
And awaiting Jack Lew as their new
overlord.
The overlord. You know, what I'm struck with in today's Times story is the government's part in this and this flawed procedure of farming out these scouring the millions of foreclosures to farming that out to consulting firms that charge as much as $250 an hour and then outsourced that work, the consulting firms did, to people who had no experience in this at all and who just simply, you know, well, I don't know whether this deserves any more or not. In other words, the government made a hash of trying to figure out a fairer procedure.
Matt in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
My question is, why haven't these bankers been held accountable?
Whoa, Matt, I'm afraid you're just pinging, ponging on us off your cell phone there. I'm afraid we lost that something about bank accountability. I'm not sure where that one goes. Let's get another right here. Mark in Natick, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at the Hall of Fame vote, and I think it was right on.
Cooperstown saying no thanks to Bonds and Clemens and Sousa and McGuire and right on.
Hey, they entertained us while they were there, but they cheated. And you can't change that. You can't go back and change that. So I'm sorry, but I don't think they should ever get in. Maybe they should have a Cheaters Hall of Fame, and then those guys can be the first guys voted in.
Okay, let's look at generational morality here. I don't know what this is going to amount to ultimately. Tom Jelton, I don't know if you're a crazy baseball fan or not, but what's your gut reaction to this? The doors were not opened to these this generation of sort of the steroid-era players this week. And then you had people saying, well, maybe down the line we'll change our attitudes and they'll be in. I'm not sure what that means. When we have robotic pitching arms and all kinds of other supplements, but what did you think? Just on the face of it, Tom.
Just from my in my personal opinion, I cheered that they did not get in. I agree with Mark. I mean, I think there's no place for cheaters in the Hall of Fame, and several of those. Now, you mentioned Sammy Sosa. There's Mark McGuire. There's mm-hmm. Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens. Very strong evidence against all of them that they did cheat, that they used performance enhancing drugs. I think the question is whether this was just a kind of a symbolic reaction in the first ballot, first year, you know, they're going to be eligible in future years as well. And that's going to be when the real test comes.
Jack, are you ever going to open your heart to the steroid generation?
Not mine. And I'm struck with how players like Jeff Bagwell and Mike Piazza, who have not been linked to any drug use, at least explicitly, they seem to have fallen under this cloud as well. I mean, there seems to be just a whole generational cloud of suspicion. If you played baseball in these years, if your body pumped up, if you went from being a singles hitter to, you know, a Babe Ruth, you are under suspicion whether you've been connected to drug use or not.
Tough times in sports journalism. What do you say, Diane?
One thing I want to mention is, you know, this is also next week, Lance Armstrong, just to bring the steroid full circle, is going on to Oprah to talk about his experiences with that. And it is a culture. When you've got excellence in sport being associated with drug use, it's very hard to separate out. And unfortunately, it does taint a whole generation.
We'll see if Lance Armstrong manages to climb up out of that. It looks like he's about to try. We'll be watching. Hey, Tom, take us south for a minute. There was this amazing conversation out of Venezuela this week as people watched to see whether Hugo Chavez would come back for his inauguration. He's been treated for cancer, apparently quite serious, in Cuba, did not make it back. And so far, he's still the leader of the country, as far as I know. What do you see going on in Venezuela, our southern neighbor there, Tom?
Well, the position of the Chavez government seems to be that because Hugo Chavez was clearly elected president in the fall, that he is the president and will be as long as he's alive. And they have such control, Tom, over all the political institutions in Venezuela, beginning with the Supreme Court and the National Assembly, that basically if they, as a movement, as a regime, say that Hugo Chavez will remain our president no matter what, they're going to get away with it. The Constitution, on the other hand, seems to me to be pretty clear that January 10th is the beginning of a new term, and if the president cannot exercise functions at the beginning of that term, then there's a whole procedure laid out for new elections and, you know, interim presidents and so forth. But, you know, in Venezuela, they can pretty much ignore that, interpret the Constitution as they want. And I think this big demonstration yesterday in Venezuela on the day that Hugo Chavez was supposed to begin his new term showed that politically they can get away with it. Now, as far as Chavez himself, we haven't heard anything from him for a month.
Notably.
We've had the vice president speaking on his behalf about his condition. I think it's very suspicious that Chavez has not managed to send a tweet, a phone call, anything. I mean, Maduro, the vice president, says he's had extensive conversations with Chavez. If that, in fact, is true, it's hard to understand why Chavez could not say something over the telephone to the people of Venezuela. I think the chances are that he is in very bad shape. There are reports that he's, you know, having trouble breathing, may even be comatose. I think that he probably is very, very sick. And I know that a lot of people that follow the situation closely are convinced that he will never return to public life.
I mean, in fairness, extremely awkward for any republic to have its head of state laid up on Inauguration Day. I don't even know what the law is here on that front, but that's just an awkward situation. Diane, I want to bring this $1 trillion coin back to you. Why doesn't this thing go? Why are people still talking? It sounds so nutty, and yet you've still got people talking about it. Is this just a joke that the Treasury would mint a $1 trillion coin, hand it over to, you know, pay off liabilities, and the debt ceiling, presto, it's gone?
I know, put it in the slot machine, and there we go.
Why is this still being talked about?
I think there's a lot of concern coming up. You know, we've gone to the point where we almost forget the game of chicken that took place the last time we had the debt ceiling. Now that we've gone over the cliff, we have that looming. And people are nervous about what if they don't come to an agreement? There is going to be no $1 trillion coin. What's surprising to me is that nobody's really pressed the president, you know, while he's talking about the loopy signature of his potential Treasury Secretary. Let's address this whole $1 trillion coin idea. It's unfortunately not that easy a fix, but does sound compelling, doesn't it?
How about all the president's men? That photograph of the president being advised by that big, looks like fraternity brothers stretched before him.
He needs a binder full of women. But, you know, it's when you go through that binder for Obama, it is, you look at the choices. Obviously, Susan Rice took herself out for Secretary of State. So, boom, there's John Kerry. And when I think about the other choices, Sheila Bair, given sort of what on her book tour, I think she made some gaffes.
Is it too early to go after him? I mean, that was an all male lineup. But on the other hand, he's got a lot more cabinet picks for the second term to name here. Is it too early to jump on him or not, Diane?
Well, there is, if you look beyond gender, there's certainly diversity of, religion and background. But no, it's unfortunate. And especially given what he did his first term, it's unfortunate when you think that really so far we have white men of a certain age. And this is a president who got in part because he was supposed to represent everybody. But pipeline issue.
Well,
I hate to say it.
Maybe.
Is the case.
We'll see where he ends up. I mean, one thing that's notable here, Tom Gelton, is we've had a woman as Secretary of State for so long that flipping that is kind of eye-grabbing. How many years it was a female Secretary of State?
Yeah, we had, three in a row? The best quote on this, Tom, from Carl Linderforth said, "We've moved from a team of rivals to a band of brothers."
Band of brothers, we'll see. You can bet they're going to be mixing that up and soon. Well, I would think so anyway. Tom Gelton with NPR, Diane Brady, Bloomberg Business Week, Jack Beatty, you're all terrific. Thanks for joining us. And listeners, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.